Thank you. Welcome to the panel of Political Economy of Art. My name is So-Young Yoon, and I have the honor of chairing this panel. We have three speakers today, Ruth Dennison, Pablo Bustundu, and Ben Davis. I will give a short introduction of each presenter before their presentation, and then we only have three speakers today, so each presentation, there's a lot of time for us to hear all of the papers and then have a lengthy discussion afterwards. So we'll start off with Ruth Dennison. Ruth Dennison is an associate professor of modern and contemporary American poetry at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She has recently published The Zhukovsky Era, Modernity, Margins, and the Avant-Garde, published by John Hopkins in 2012. Her current project is entitled Figurative Capital, Poetry, and the World System, 1929 to 1989.
Okay, my paper is entitled 297308, which are dates. Okay. Poetry, Crisis, and a Hermeneutic of Limits. It revolves around poetry, but there's enough to get your hooks into if you're not a poetry person, so bear with me. There's only one close reading in the entire paper, so the ride will be okay, I think. Okay. Our current crisis, whose phenomenal inauguration began in 2008, continues to structure and transform the critical practices of Marxists and non-Marxists alike. In what follows, I want to chart two waypoints in a historical terrain opened up by, the global capitalist crisis, a marked upswing in anti-capitalist struggle, and a corollary set of shifts and foreclosures in an American humanities critical culture that is increasingly polarized between those whose methods confront the assaults on the very existence of remunerated cultural critique, and those whose methods respond just as sensitively to the aggressions of austerity, but turn instead to micro-ontologies, new materialisms, and neo-formalisms. My paper emerges as a response to the following question. What are the opportunities of vision and hermeneutic opened up by our experience of the first deep crisis that unfurled after the definitive end of the hemispheric antinomies structured by the Cold War? My concerns here are literary, and my examples are drawn from 20th century American poetics. This means, one, that I write from a targeted disciplinary space whose assailants are veterans of earlier battles, namely against what remains of ethnic studies. And two, my objects of study are not the traditional sites of Marxist inquiry. And as such, I hope, tunnel us out of a critical sediment composed of an increasingly infinite history of revisions of one concept, narrative. Okay. My current project, Figurative Capital, American Poetry and the World System, 1929 to 1984, is in part a response to what our current crisis has revealed. The invisible temporalities of circulation must be mapped upon, alongside, over, and under the still visible geographies of uneven development, lest they calcify into the basis for another announcement of a new capitalism. As Joshua Clover has explained, this is a tidy rundown of what our economy looks at like. As real accumulation ebbed after Brenner's long boom of 48 to 73, competition for extant profits intensified. This intensification can be seen in the offshoring of labor and the tax revolts that inaugurated neoliberalism, in capital's leap to finance in search of profit, and in the need for manufacturing firms to turn over their stock more swiftly to conform to what Harvey named socially necessary turnover time. Accelerated turnover demands more credit-based liquidity while at the same time expelling labor from production. Thus, the rise in finance is correlated with the rise of both speculative value and immaterial labor, but this indicates a problem in production, not a new source or mode. Finance is neither cause nor solution for this problem, but its veil. Pick up a couple of keywords in Clover's summary here. Hurried, swift, accelerated. Such characterizations of the temporalities of financialization are apt. But our crisis has proven that it is not, ultimately, possible to annihilate space by time. The textual geographies of non-narrative poetic form temporalize space and spatialize temporality. As such, big claim. They are the historically adequate mediations of the combined and uneven spatial simultaneities in what appear as the homogeneous landscapes of capitalism, just as much as they are mediations of the temporal lags, disbandings, speed shifts, and clogs in what appears to be frictionless, endless turnover. For this reason, poetics is the form of the crisis, providing us with entry points into the value form and into the ontology of this and other capitalist disasters. The broadest query of this hermeneutic is, how does 20th and 21st century poetry strive to represent the unrepresentable? If the unrepresentable is, by definition, the global capitalist totality in which we live and from which we are hived off. On the level of praxis, we might ask, how does poetry offer ways for its readers to grasp the contours of the global economy? Since the main force of poetry resides in the figural, the unseen, metaphors, similes, line breaks, vast and micro fields of white space, allusions, it is quite possibly uniquely suited to represent a world financial system that is increasingly conducted in an invisible manner through derivatives, currency trading, outsourcing, collateralized debt obligations, etc. American poetry itself has shifted its formal strategies in concert with changes in the forms of exploitation from Depression-era parataxis to the anti-lyrical material signifiers that emerged within and against the banner of neoliberalism. Poetics, then, is the print analog to cinema. It screens the dynamic interplay between spatial and temporal fixes to crisis. Okay, so this is my overarching, I'll get into waypoint one of my two waypoints. Okay. So waypoint one. It's a methodology I'm calling comparative crises. The comparison, better even triangulation, of the three major crises of the 20th and 21st centuries, 29, 73, 08, trains a critical aperture on textual prolepsis, where form anticipates limits to capital or revolutionary possibilities as yet unpeeled by history. Similarly, the textual products of more aged crises, like our own, retroactively illuminate, lay bare prehistories in older texts. Comparative crises inoculate against habitual, myopic pronouncements regarding the newness of our own moment. Okay, so that's the sort of broader waypoint, which I'll explain in greater detail. I will begin by saying that embedded in this methodology is a call for the transformation of the manner and ways that Marxism produces knowledge about our present world and its historical antecedents. In the available institutional memory, Marxist cultural theory and literary criticism has practiced ideology critique with special attention to the contraction of vision produced by reification, the fetish, and the pernicious effects of the culture industry. To turn to the crises and radical responses to the crises of the 30s, of the 70s, and of our present is to expand our critical work beyond pointing up contradiction into frontiers where we might trace the conjunctures that have stenciled what Jody Dean has called the communist horizon. I neither agree nor disagree with everything in Jody Dean's theory, but it's a useful sort of banner. Okay. Revolutions and revolts around the globe have adopted the myriad forms of the Bolivarian process, the Egyptian Revolution, the Wisconsinian Union Vanguard's occupation, barricades smashed and re-erected for the first time since 68 and 99, for those of you in Seattle. Our moment announces the need for a turn from dour Marxism and toward a vigorously historical utopianism. To compare crisis is to find continuities not only in the limits at which capital constantly claws back, it is also to find continuities of communization. To find out how Flint, 36, 37, is and is not the American Indian Movement's 1969 occupation of Alcatraz, which is and is not the Oakland Commune and West Coast port shutdowns of 2012. Triangulating our crisis with its 1930s and 1970s antecedent forms is part of renewing the visibility of the communist horizon and part of understanding how our own crisis is both historically specific and singular, but also a punctual moment in an ongoing process of immiseration and radicalization. Anti-communism continuously constructs, clips, redeploys, and refashions the historical record of the politics and aesthetics of the crisis, such that their crisis is our crisis. The literary record confirms this The corpse of modernism has been raised and reanimated at various points in capitalist crisis. The ideology of American poetic modernism was first concretized by the Southern agrarian poets who had migrated to Northern institutions. Poets like John Crow Ransom and Alan Tate would brand their modernism in the embers of Confederate nostalgia and anti-New Dealerdom. The tectonics of American uneven development produced a conjuncture in which these new critics would protect vibrantly historical works like The Wasteland from history in a velvety alembic of formal integrity. By mid-century, the new criticism, whose, again, primary authors were these Southern agrarians, produced a modernism that excluded from the historical record whole trajectories of communist, anarchist, socialist, black nationalist, and internationalist and utopian poetic interventions. Skipping forward to the 70s, the first strains of neoliberalism saw the opening of the poetic archive to discover precisely what had been excluded by these previous narratives. Riding the crest of the next great capitalist crisis of the 20th century after the long 1930s, in the 1970s, the language poets had to produce their prehistory in those radical Zhukovskian and Steinian modernisms that had been coffined from view. In general, there was a retethering of poetry to resistance. Hannah Wiener and the American Indian Movement, Amiri Baraka and Beat Disaffection from the Rationalization of the Labor Process, Amiri Baraka and Malcolm X, Antler and Rank and File Machine Sabotage, and on and on. These new constellations of the 1970s were, I want to argue, at once reconfigurations and remediations, continuities, of the older first crisis alliances between the avant-garde and revolutionary movements in the 1930s. Now we find ourselves in this, the third major crisis in the functioning of capital. God, I hope there's no medievalists or whatever. This is 20th and 21st century. The third crisis of the 20th and 21st century. In functioning of capital, and as this waypoint suggests, the modernist conjuncture provides an absolutely necessary prehistory to our current moment of global capitalist crisis. In returning to these preceding moments, this return might be best conducted as part of this methodology I'm calling that of comparative crisis, in which cultural critique at minimum triangulates the critical energies it devotes to tracing the roots of our moment with the onset of the rise of neoliberalism in the 1970s and with the 20th century's first moment of crisis, or 29, is it shorthand. Examples of the critical turn of our present to the 1970s are vast, and I'm sure that we all share these waypoints. Théorie communiste, renewal of communization theory and libertarian Marxism, a renaissance of interest in autonomous feminist accounts of affective labor, such as those of Federici and Selma James, attractive in part as we contend with the increasing production of non-factory forms of labor. Labor histories of American wildcat strikes, C.F. Brenner and Winslow's Rebel Rank and File, recent anthology, and the political and cultural economies of the 1970s in general. Key texts include Judith Stein's Pivotal Decade or Jefferson Cowie's Staying Alive. So there's a sort of tremendous amount of critical energy in considering the roots of this crisis in the 1970s. Also, the popularity of Badouin and anarcho-communisms with their roots in 68, ecstatic workerism, and spontaneous comportments. David Harvey's 1982 Limits to Capital has found a new generation of readers under its reissuing. Okay, so when we triangulate our prehistories, reaching back behind the historical shadows cast over the 70s to the 30s modernist moment, which, as Jameson argues, has always been with us, we resist the historical narrative that periodizes us at one with the 70s only by instantiating a break with the 30s. Such a break certainly costs us not only a continuity of struggle, it also produces a narrative that simultaneously aligns our crisis with the rise of austerity and financialization, while de-yoking us from features of crisis that were more prominent or visible in the 1930s, ones which we certainly share now: unemployment, overproduction, the poisonous rise of the ratio of investment to the organic composition of capital. What if instead each crisis, as Harvey would have it, offers a new window on the limits to capital, windows which our comparisons keep continuously ajar? And this is Harvey. Marx sees each relation as a separate window from which we can look at inner structures of capitalism. The view from any one window is flat and lacks perspective. When we move to another window, we can see things that were formerly hidden from view. Armed with that knowledge, we can reinterpret and reconstitute our understanding of what we saw through the first window, giving it greater depth and perspective by moving from window to window to window and carefully recording what we see, we come closer and closer to understanding capitalist society in all of its inherent contradictions. Of course, Harvey's window is existing chronically, allowing the value form to be viewed from multiple perspectives, the commodity form, production, consumption, etc. Crisis comparison invests these perspectives with the diachronic historical dimension, wherein each crisis opens up a transom, illuminating a door through which we might see the future and the past. But the diachronic, it turns out, always dialectically returns us to the landscape of the present. Here, new contradictions do not replace old ones, but are sedimented atop them or spatially bestride them. For example, what would it mean to read the halting failures of the MCM transaction, which always clog up the roots of global financialization, as a reshifted mediation of the contest between labor and capital, and of the territorialization of all space by the needs of capital, the signature of visible oppositions of the 1930s? And now I turn to this poem that I've handed out to you, so... Hate me not. Okay. Let me briefly say how this might work in the example of Larry Eigner's poetry. Eigner's work, whose hard-won composition, given his lifelong non-ambulatory condition, is a subject that's a subject for a much more expansive inquiry elsewhere. But his work stitches together two moments in the evolution of a materialist poetics, Black Mountain and Language. That is to say, his work, closely associated with both schools, sublates, one, Black Mountain's neoliberal pre-Vietnam fantasy of a textual open field in which the unified breath of a speaking, writing, aspirating body found its exact perceptual corollary in the type space of the page, effectively incinerating mediations of ideology and history. So it's a sublation of that, and also, two, Language poetry's turn to the signifier of the word itself, the hard-won wisdom of the neoliberal turn in forming a permanent consciousness of language as a brutal mediation of other systems, darker orders. Eigner's signature windowscape, so he's sort of non-ambulatory, writes a lot of his poetry sitting at a window, partly a function, again, of non-ambulatory necessity, displays a curatorial selective fidelity to the geographical particulars he surveys. This is from his 1977 collection, The Word and Its Streets, Places. I'm against all forms of the hieratic voice, and I hate reading poetry. Okay. His life, the open window, where the clock sounds fade, what is it? Branches out there. Can you stop the war? Crickets, stars, no birds, the more air, sing in the leaves, get up and speak. Something, whatever it is, wilds around, now, now. Three central themes convene in these opening lines to this is a longer poem. Political will, the non-submission of nature to the value form, and the unrepresentability of whatever it is that might comprise a reforested and repopulated commons whose wilds mark what lies on the other side of the spatial limits to capital. The measured time that scores rhythms of accumulation and labor disappears, clock sounds fade, and in doing so opens up an unsettled, inquisitive relationship to the out there that lies beyond the walls of domestic privacy. The geographic particulars, crickets, stars, air, birds, leaves, weigh equally on both sides, you can see this informally, of the scale composed by empty type space. And in this fantastical scale, more sits bestride and is equal to no. This is precisely what regimes of exchange and fictions of supply and demand fungibility cannot confess, that within the value form lies a series of surpluses, thefts, devaluations, and accretions which split wages, prices, and labor time phenomenally asunder. The poem's anti-logical scales, constructed of the dynamic space between space, the dynamic between space and type, between the excesses, more air, and the absences and or silence, no birds are the numerator, impossibly less than the denominator of their singing, of nature, weigh the secret inequalities that reside within the dashes of MCM. The current renaissance of value form theory and the return of the question of the commons and the natural surfeit therein theoretically returns only really possible after the historical convergence of capitalist crisis and the left's regroupment after Stalinism and reformism, affords this window onto Eigner's window. But even this window is only widened when we construct an analytic triangle of crises. Our moment, Eigner's own simultaneously neoliberalizing and countercultural 1970s, and the modernist moment. Because Eigner is also working most acutely at the contact point of a recognizably older modernist tension, the production of an ever more differentiated and uneven capitalist space which will tirelessly produce nature as the opposite of us, a space which Lefebvre reminds us began with the surrealists, who, like Eigner, would transcode the inner life of the subject of capital, its freedoms and unfreedoms, into increasingly autonomous topographies of natural space and street space and private space. Okay. So that's waypoint two, which is shorter. Capitalism is not a topic. The representation of capital itself is, of course, impossible. Its sheer size and abstraction could never fully concretize in a text. The representation of communism is also not possible. We can plan for it, though. Okay. However, poetry encodes in its forms and contents a vast array of limits to capital. The excavation of the limit is a form of criticism responsible to the experience and fact of permanently recurring crises. The limit is the dialectical complement to the traditional task of totalizing. It locates a failure of capital to valorize just as it locates a place for physical and critical occupations. As Harvey has lushly explicated, these limits include spatial and temporal barriers to the valorization of capital, and in that, the reproduction of the value form, circulatory blockages of all manners, from state intervention to the contracted consumption of immiserated workers, employed and unemployed, class struggle against the wage form and against life at the machine and the screen, overproduction and the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, the temptations and hazards of total vertical integration, et cetera, this is just a sort of summary of limits to capital. Capital can only ever be approached by texts askance, in partial ways that result in marvelous failures that give rise to the contradictions that propel the text into halting semiotic coherences. The new neo-empiricisms, object-oriented ontologies, affect theory, thing theory, animalisms, surface reading, and the like, are more and more finding poetics a site of inquiry. Good God. Lauren Berlant's John Ashbery in Cruel Optimism, or Bill Brown's W.C. William in The Sense of Things, or Timothy Morton's Percy Shelley in An Object-Oriented Defense of Poetry, or the methodology of surface reading, which take poetry as their point of departure. These and many other new empiricisms will continue to rise, compensatory salves for the temporary expulsion of Marxism from the university and from social life. The sheer proliferation of object-oriented ontology entry points, whether it be the animal or the stone, is a symptom of anxiety about that totality towards which modernism itself strove asymptotically. The neo-empiricism offer no re-entry point for criticism into social life, and their unannounced point of departure is the rejection of mediation in total. In these critical anti-imaginaries, capitalism is a permanent atmosphere. It may be characterized by permanent crises, but it is not a transcendable horizon, despite the production of vast numbers of subjects who see right through it and persist, against Berlant's warning, to act against their own interests and against ways that they really ought to feel. By some contrast, I want to suggest a reading practice that reads below the surface, less to find a symptom than to chart the sedimentation again of these three major periods of 20th and 21st century capitalist crisis. To read those sedimented inscriptions through epiphenomenal topica is to miss the opportunity to see the ways in which older texts are opened up by those of our moment and vice versa. Each crisis rises out of and lays bare new limits and wrenches open new forms of consciousness. Here we might revisit a text from their depression from the perspective of our depression in an effort to paratact these two crises consciousness. And here I'm thinking of Muriel Rukeyser's 1938 long poem chronicling the Hawk's Nest tunnel disaster, which is a mining disaster, called The Book of the Dead. And it offers multiple windows to the limits of capital. Nature, which demanded a diversion of this river, which created the sort of environmental and workplace disaster. The lungs of the workers, these are all sort of invisible limits, which collapsed at the limit of extraction of relative surplus value. The cost required of capital to build the predicative fixed capital required for an even larger industrial project, and the ruinous short-sightedness produced by the capitalist discovery of the unexpected super profits from silica. The poem delivers a dizzying array of formal strategies, the proliferation of which signifies the structurally unrepresentable fact of a totality and of a crisis in that totality. And these are its various attempts to capture limits. It uses testimony, quasi-pastoral portraits, reportage, paratactical high modernism, Dickinsonian type silence, etc. Each strategy flowers, then runs out of steam before moving on to another, and each strategy marks the limits of the form and the limits of capital, limits of form and the limits of capital. Ruckheiser's poem addresses the sub and invisible, the interior of the lung, the interior of the extractive tunnel. This should matter to us now because it gives us pause as we receive neoliberal narratives about financialization's spectacular, novel, invisible immaterialities. When we open the window of the 30s onto the window of the present, we find that the invisibility of the current crisis isn't novel, but rather a mutating remediation at the level of circulation of older invisibilities. Absolute and relative surplus value extraction, accumulation through dispossession, lending regimes rooted in racism. So in conclusion, in this piece, I've suggested that poetic form provides a historically apt textual mediation of the rapidly proliferating limits to capital. While each poem responds to its ambient catastrophe and the communist negation thereof, it is also marbled by older failures of capitalism to thrive, and illuminated by future ones. It is not surprising that mediation should return as an object of debate at a time in which the failures of capital appear imminent, obvious, and at a time in which the humanities have undergone sustained attack, only to respond, by and large, through appeals to, by turns, conventional philologies and curation, or from any new materialisms to the imagined disciplinary authority of the harder sciences. However, there can be no theory of transition without one of mediation, and when crises, past, present, and future, churn and burst forth from the forms of the imagination, we find ourselves needing to confront the question of both. Thanks.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Pablo Bustundu. He's a PhD candidate in the Department of Philosophy at the New School for Social Research. He's writing a dissertation on democracy and the critique of space. The paper he's going to present is part of an ongoing book project co-authored with the Spanish sociologist Jorge Lago on the relation between politics and fiction. Thank you.
So my paper has a new title, The Fictional Structure of Ideology, but it still deals a lot with political fictions and also a little with communism. It is part of a work in progress with a Spanish sociologist called Jorge Lago on the political use of narrative structures and more specifically on what we have called the poetics of antagonism. Our investigation originated after the events of May 2011 in Madrid, when we were struck by a sudden popular obsession with names and with the way political stories are told. Those days, people were unanimously chanting, "They call it democracy, but it is not." They shouted as well, "They cannot represent us." The funny thing is that there is an expression in Spanish which would be roughly translated as "not even God," in order to say nobody, right? So people were yelling, "Not even God can represent us." And of course, representation, as Hobbes reminded us, is a poetic concept before being a political one, and one which has to do with the act of speaking in the name of another. In general, we perceive that a common instinctive feature of this widely heterogeneous movement was a rejection of dominant narratives that were explicitly denounced as fictions, that is, as imaginary fabrications that did not or did no longer correspond to the reality people were living in. This gap between what was said and what was experienced became then a very fertile political space. Of course, the opposition of fiction to truth is not a particularly promising or even an interesting one. The dead ends of the critique of ideology have made it clear enough that it makes no sense to simply oppose fiction to truth, as if one could dream of a politics without fiction, a self-transparent politics that would dissolve the distinction between the imaginary and the real. Lacan said that the truth has a fictional structure, and we know that fiction does not lie. Fiction makes as if it was telling the truth, which is a very different thing. What we came to see in the squares, in fact, was not the mere dismissal of particular political fictions, nor a grand denunciation of fiction in itself, but something more complex, the rejection of a specific way of fictionalizing politics, of using the narrative space of fiction so as to solve or dissolve what would be otherwise experienced as an untenable conflict. This is what we called resolutive fictions, an ideological structure that aims at deactivating a social conflict or antagonism by means of its narrative displacement and depoliticization. That is the structure that we put at the center of our investigation. A resolutive fiction, then, is a narrative construct that takes a contradiction of the present, a material dissonance, a clash of senses, an antagonism demanding resolution, and presents it as a necessary element or a moment integrated within a plot, a story that will lead, or has already led without our noticing it, to its resolution. The virtue of such a narrative is to leave the conflict untouched while making it appear as being already solved. Think, for instance, of the most banal example, those classic novels in which the class conflict of industrial capitalism is narratively solved through the triumph of love between a poor servant and a rich gentleman, or the other way around, over their insurmountable social difference. The class conflict is thus perceived from the beginning as something destined to disappear, not by means of social transformation, but through the affective experience of the characters. In empathizing with them, one can do as if that difference didn't really exist or matter anymore, fictionally solving something that otherwise could not disappear without forcing the subject to enter the field of politics and social contradiction. This illusion deactivates the reality of the conflict and leaves its social experience untouched. What we found interesting is that this structure seems to be applicable not only to poetic constructs or literary stories, but also to some of the main ideological narratives that drew an origin and a horizon for the modern state and the capitalist market. In fact, we want to argue that this double movement, backward and forward, opening at the same time an origin and a horizon, constitutes something like the fictional spine of capitalist ideology, a narrative structure that dissolves the contradiction intrinsic to its present by displacing them towards an impossible future or an equally implausible past. To be sure, capitalism entertains a problematic relationship with fiction. In its ascending phase, capital became a great machine for the destruction of social and political plots, all the organic principles and metaphysical justifications that would guarantee the meaningfulness of social bonds and the stability of socio-political orders. Instead, capitalist relations of production become the hegemonic instance binding individuals to social spaces and activities. By subjecting those spaces and relations to a relentless competition, however, and to the constant violence of appropriation and class struggle, capitalism never ceases to tear apart and refashion those bonds, installing a fracture at the very heart of society. We want to argue that the fictional displacement towards the future and the past is one of the ways through which capitalist ideology covers that fracture and dissipates its inherent fundamental tension. Take, for instance, the complex narrative that the reproduction of capital tends to thread around the themes of progress, equality, and growth. Each of these has in common that it refers to a future that is both open and yet to be made. Each explains and defines the present based on something other than itself, something that is yet to come, but still manages to act as an exclusive distributor of reasons and meanings. This can be seen in the obscenely fictional structure of the American dream, the source of meaning for individual trajectories, that which justifies the efforts of people at the bottom, is in the not yet, in the goal that will be achieved, when tomorrow's social and economic success will reveal the truth of the present toiling and suffering. At another scale, this is the same fictional structure at work in the great obsessions with growth, in the promises of formal equality and redistribution, or in the ideology of debt. When such narratives work, the projection of a future of plenty deactivates the structural contradictions of the present, justifying them in the name of that future and making them appear as contingent elements that are destined to wither away. The anticipated image of a future that never comes narratively dissolves the lived contradictions of the present moment. Asymmetric movement is at work in the fictional displacements towards the past. Think of the constitutional logic of modern states and the political philosophy of contractualism that served as its foundation. Never mind that the state of nature from which the state emerged never actually existed, that its space and time are hence merely logical or hypothetical, that they are the coordinates of a purely fictional scene. The contract's role is to abolish in fiction something substantial about the present, and precisely that which challenges its own conditions of possibility. It takes the problematic heterogeneity of society, the great multitude of interests, groups, and individuals that make the state's monopoly of power unthinkable, and displaces it into the fictional time and space of the contract, where their unity and discipline as a people can be presupposed and consequently enforced. Thanks to that fictional projection, the conflict that results from social fractures, class conflict, social separation, competition and division of labor, the logic of property and appropriation, the impossible unity and equality of subjects, can be presented as having already been dealt with, already solved. Any lingering problem becomes an accident to be suppressed by the restoration of that logic. Again, the causes and reasons of social conflicts are displaced, and the space of fiction supplants and forecloses any space for political action and expression. We believe that understanding the fictional logic of contractualism is particularly relevant to situate the current crisis of the European left, and especially the crisis of the social democratic paradigm. Because what was the European social democracy if not an actualization of the theory of the social contract, this time under the guise of a Keynesian deal between capital and labor? The fictional logic is mostly the same, an alleged free covenant that mystifies its own conditions of possibility, giving a legitimate origin to the social order and tracing a horizon for the futurization of social conflict, a horizon of growth, progress, redistribution, equality, and so on, so as to neutralize the revolutionary ambitions of the working class. From this perspective, social democracy appears almost as the perfect paradigm of a contractual resolutive fiction, providing both an origin and a horizon for the neutralization of social conflict and political division. Arguably, this has been the fictional spine of most of Europe's post-war regimes. So, when people denounce that austerity is a dictatorship and that the social contract has been broken, as they are doing right now, they are pointing to the fact that the capitalist collapse has caused at the same time a collapse of this mechanism of displacement. Without that narrative, people are suddenly faced with the reality of conflict in all of its crudeness, and one seems to lack even the words to name it. This is what has been happening in Spain. People recognize that the narrative has broken apart and that the founding fictions of social democracy and democratic representation hold no longer, that we are calling things with names that have lost their meaning, that have no grip on social existence. So we are back at the original scene, people in the squares organizing around the very denunciation of that fact, saying that things are not what they say them to be, embodying the very fracture, refusing to let it go. To be sure, there is something to be said as well about the landscape surrounding the scene, the fictional nakedness of capitalist obscenity, which could not care less about people's rage and disbelief. In this respect, there is a remarkable difference between what we could call the fictional left, the left of the social contract, the left of social democracy, and the fictional regime of neoliberalism. Neoliberalism could perhaps be understood as the moment in which capital tried to do without resolutive fictions, as the dream of a capitalism which would no longer need to displace the political impossibility of the real, not because the social conflict had disappeared, but because the definitive victory of capital over Soviet communism had neutralized as well any possible imagination of an alternative state of affairs, and hence the need to even say anything about it, as if the end of history, in a way, entailed as well an end of the stories to be told. Neoliberalism stopped assuming that the presence of social conflicts, of inequality, poverty, exploitation, misery, domination, was something threatening or traumatic in itself, something that didn't hence to be hidden or concealed. In the face of capitalist obscenity, the social fracture and the contradictions of capital were exposed for everybody to see, in the conviction that the machine could keep functioning very well, independently of what people thought, and even when everybody knows that all of its fictions are false. In a certain sense, neoliberalism itself prepared the dismantlement of the fictional scene of capitalist modernity. So let me summarize again these two thoughts. First, in the Europe of austerity, the obscenity of capital reigns almost without need of words, which is both a sign of strength, but also a potential cause of weakness. Second, the collapse of the fictional left, of social democracy as we knew it, seems to be pretty definitive and has left a huge narrative void, plenty of space for an anti-capitalist politics. We believe that the conjunction of these two facts is what made so productive the facts of 2011, the politicization of that gap between what is said and what is experienced. There is a certain distance that has been gained from the logic of resolutive fictions, a distance that is no longer manifested through cynicism, that is, doing as if one believed something that one actually does not, or mere indignation, but faces now the challenge of its articulation and political mobilization. The question that we would like to raise then is how a materialist theory of fiction could contribute to such a political articulation. And we believe that such a contribution should begin by a fictional critique of Orthodox Marxism. Orthodox Marxism, in fact, generated its own apparatus of resolutive fictions. Think, for instance, of the canonical time frame established by Lenin in State and Revolution. In the first phase of the revolution, the socialization of the means of production leads to the constitution of state monopolies, which must enforce a rigorous work discipline for the salary of a worker. The state must also take charge of the distribution of goods and the repression of the last remnants of bourgeois resistance. This temporary survival of the state, of bourgeois law, and of other elements of coercion is an inevitable symptom of the direct transition from capitalism to socialism, and of course creates a number of contradictions. In the second phase, however, the function of social administration will be simplified to the point where they will disappear as functions and lose hence their political character. At that point, the point of the self-overcoming of the universal class, the conflicts derived from the immaturity of a people grown under capitalism will finally disappear in a new society that will culminate the economic, political, and anthropological revolution of full communism. This is a paradigmatic fictional resolution, by virtue of which the social contradictions of the present are displaced to a space and time in which they can appear as already solved. The future of full communism acts then as the phantasmatic justification for those contradictions, generating a theodicy in which everything happens for a reason and gets its justification in the name of something that doesn't exist yet. The problem, as we know, is that such a horizon of meaningfulness does not cease to retract, like a shadow that one can never catch. There is another literary example that I particularly like. Bogdanov's novel Red Star, which was written shortly after the defeat of 1905, and had great success after the revolution. It tells the story of a Bolshevik scientist who is contacted by a Martian delegation on a secret visit to Earth and taken as a representative of humanity on a visit to the Red Planet. Once there, the scientist discovers a much more advanced civilization to the point that it has embraced communism a couple centuries before the Soviet Union. The narrator can hence see the future of the socialist revolution that is about to begin on Earth, a future in which the new man, the new Martian in this case, is an accomplished reality and where social conflict does not exist at all. All the suffering, the defeats, and the difficulties of the revolutionary struggle could hence be justified from the point of view of what will happen in another space-time that, from that distance, justifies the meaningfulness of the present. In a sublime poetic gesture, Bogdanov's novel displaces the antagonisms of the Soviet present all the way to Mars. There would be much more to say about all this, but the point is that such a counter-fictional strategy should no longer be available in order to think communism today. I mentioned before the dead ends of any critique of ideology that is based on the premise of the awakening, of the explosion of consciousness that, once liberated from the veil of deceit and alienation, can finally confront the truth of history, understand its logic, and transform the world from its root. This was the model of revolution as the transition to a self-transparent society, a society where the emancipation from domination would coincide with the emancipation from fiction, where freedom would fully coincide with truth. But in the most literal possible sense, communism cannot look elsewhere. The task today is not to formulate the thousandth escape to a communist beyond, to a future or a past without difference, to a social unity without division or social remainders. From this perspective, the task would be to think of communism as a non-resolutive fictional space, whose aim would not be to sublimate the fractures of the social, but to assume them as the very source of collective emancipation. A materialist conception of fiction would recognize ideology not as a homogeneous structure, but as a productive and immanent battlefield, a place of constructions and destructions between forces and resistance that oppose, confront, or combine with each other. It would not lend itself to the religious dream of a politics without fiction, nor would it try to sublimate, displace, or ignore the fractured nature of the real, but rather would assume it as a common political habitat. An optimistic reading of what happened in the political explosions of 2011 could then say that the immense energy that was then liberated was pointing, however confusedly, precisely in that direction. Perhaps the temerity of the squares, their willingness to occupy the spaces of obscenity, their openness and disposition to conflicting discourses and practices, their instinctive rejection of representation, their non-coincidence with themselves and even the pathological jouissance of their own crisis, perhaps all these traits could be understood just as a first infantile gesture towards a different communist politics, a politics of a higher fictional order, which would not displace its conflict somewhere else, but would adapt them as a source of Gemeinwesen, of community and being with others. Such an immanent politics, a communism of the present that would socialize both the production of meaning and its failure, would be very different from the thousandth fictional version of a transcendent communist truth. Thank you.
Our last speaker is Ben Davis, who's an art critic. His writing has appeared in Adbusters, Slate.com, The Village Voice, and elsewhere. He was associate editor of ArtNet magazine for 5 years and is currently executive editor of ArtInfo.com. His book, 9.5 Theses on Art and Class, is set to be published in June of this year by Haymarket.
Okay, I think I'm actually going to stand. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Everybody?
Well, I've been sitting down for a while, so might be slightly more lively, pleasant breeze for me. So we're going to change gears here to talk about visual art, because that's obviously my field of specialty. And I'll say at the outset that I'm mildly afraid that my talk is going to come off as slightly is less romantic, is more prosaic than the ones that we just had, because I'm really going to focus not on the philosophy of art or even or the politics of form, but on the context within which visual art is made and circulated and consumed. There is, however, a method to my lack of madness, and that is this. The idea of the so-called cultural economy has been, that is, that the decline, deindustrialization and the decline of blue-collar jobs is going to be replaced somehow by these cool new creative industries, including the industry of art. That's actually part of neoliberal ideology, pretty clearly. It's been a big selling point of neoliberalism. So I think that there is some utility to actually looking at how the creative economy works, seeing what its actual material contradictions are, how it's functioning. I think that's a key political task. And I'm going to give a thumbnail sketch of a page. Give a thumbnail sketch of some of that analysis. So I'll focus in this talk on the changes specific to the visual art sphere in the last, what you call the neoliberal period, the last 30 or so years. I'm going to focus in turn on four aspects of that sphere, of the visual art sphere: its audience, its market, its institutions, and finally, its producers, that is, artists themselves. So, to begin with, the audience for art. How has the audience for art changed? It's often taken for granted in a lot of theoretical writing about visual art today. The visual art has become a kind seamlessly integrated into the realm of mass entertainment and spectacle culture. And there's definitely some evident truth to that. The fact that institutions like the Tate Modern in London or the Museum of Modern Art here in New York could be drivers of economic activity and mass tourism on the level that they are today would have been really truly inconceivable a short while ago, 50 years ago, when contemporary art was still seen as more or less kind of a bohemian intellectual fringe culture. In 1970, there were about 70 art galleries in New York. Now there are hundreds, probably over 300, 200, 400. to be one of the world's top attended museums shows 20 years ago, or just yeah, 20 years ago, 1994. A show would need to have about 3,000 visitors a day. Last year, in 2012, the equivalent figure is 7,000 people a day. So there's definitely just more activity going on. And what explains that increase in activity, that transformation? In the 1960s, for radical artists like those in the Art Workers Coalition here in New York, it was still taken for granted that the key charge against museums would be that they were elitist. That is, that the culture that they reflected the values, the aesthetic values of a very small privileged minority. And that was the charge leveled against them. So the key inflection point for transforming the museum sphere into what the much more entertainment-oriented kind of milieu that it is today is in the 1970s, and comes very clearly out of the structural crisis of capitalism in the 1970s. Because of the withdrawal of public support for museums and public institutions, major museums had to restructure themselves to increasingly court mass audiences. And visitor figures became increasingly key to attracting both corporate patrons and private patrons, which became more and more important in order to sustain those institutions. And the most visible institutional symptom of this is the rise of what's called in jargon the blockbuster museum show. The inaugural and still probably the most famous example of which is the Met Museum's King Tut show of 1976, made famous by the Steve Martin song of the famous man. So it is definitely true, all the research indicates, that blockbusterization has drawn crowds to museums. But it is equally true that its success is often overstated and misunderstood. And to get at that, there are also three other factors that should be mentioned as contributing to the increased crowds, the increased lines at the museum of modern art when you try and get in. The first is just the increase in population in general. The population in the U.S. has doubled in the last 50 years. You could expect the audience to increase mechanically unless something's really going wrong. Second is the general rise in education. The single most important predictor of whether someone becomes a museum devotee is their education level. So as education became more and more pervasive in the post-World War II world, museum attendance rates went up. And the third factor is the steep increase in global tourism, particularly since the 1970s. As the world became more globally integrated, tourist volumes have about doubled in just the last decade, and that affects the number of people coming to cultural attractions. And it's important to understand it, because once you realize that, these are the factors that have driven the boom in the art audience in the last decades, and you open up the box and look in what's really going on, it starts to look like a much more troubled phenomenon. And the story doesn't seem quite so triumphalist. Even before the turn of the millennium, the audience was still growing absolutely, but people with less education showed decreasing levels of attendance at museums. So even as the audience seemed to be expanding, it was growing more stratified. And even given population expansion and so on, since the turn of the millennium, we know that the absolute audience for visual art has actually started to decline. Between 2003 and 2009, the audience dropped quite significantly, by about 19%, from 33 million visitors to 26.7 million in this period. So why don't you hear about that? It's likely because the museum world itself is very stratified. The headlines are grabbed by superstar mainstream economists called superstar institutions. They exist in large metropolitan centers that can depend on a growing tourist influx, like the Metropolitan, the MoMA in New York. But these success stories mask the overall trend. The more representative case in New York might be the Brooklyn Museum, where attendance was more than 500,000 in 1998, and now it's just over 300,000, so a pretty sharp drop. And that's a really striking decline, despite the gentrification of the borough, despite the fact that they've tried having Star Wars theme shows and giving out free popcorn. And so, and the final and most, I think evidently the most alarming note about the museum audience is about its diversity, or lack thereof. During the last election, there was a lot of talk about the emerging majority-minority society and how the Republican Party was too white to survive, need to reach out to new audiences. Well, the art audience is actually whiter than the Republican Party. It's 80% non-Hispanic white. And not only this, but in recent years, it's actually gotten less diverse as the country has gotten more so. So, well, the audience has declined across all demographics. But for whites, it was 26% in 2008 as opposed to more than 28% in 1992. So a loss of just 2 percentage points. But to compare the African American community, the drop was really alarming, from 19% to 12% in the same period. So that at least is not, you know, to say that the future of art as a mass spectacle kind of industry is probably not healthy while the masses are in a lot of distress. That's one way you could think that. At the same time, I think you read more than ever about visual art in the papers, and a lot of that is due to the tremendous rise of the art market in the same period. And I'm going to move pretty fast over this because I think it's probably the most obvious point here. But the art market's, you know, doubled in size in the last decade. The global art market was $65 billion in 2007. It fell after the crisis. It's probably back between $50 and $60 billion now. Individual works of art often sell for more than the entire annual budget for the National Endowment for the Arts. This is a Marxist audience, this is like redundant to say this, but this is obviously an outgrowth of the spectacular fortunes of the super rich in this period. The art market seems to be doing well, the real economy is stagnating. That's because of the rising inequality, that the rich are doing well, everybody else is muddling through. But that's just not like Marxist, some kind of Marxist overlay. I did want to emphasize there, you know, there's a 2010 paper by three economists. They found proof that, quote, a 1 percentage point increase in the share of total income earned for the top 0.1% triggers an increase in art prices of about 14%. It is indeed the money of the wealthy that drives art prices. This implies that we can expect art booms whenever income inequality rises quickly, which is precisely what's happened in recent history. So one way you could put this is that obvious conclusion here is that trickle-down economics doesn't work, except for art. That's a terrible way to put it. And so in the second half of this talk, what I'd emphasize is that while the art economy benefits from inequality in this way, that in another way, the contradictions of an unhinged neoliberal economy, an unbalanced neoliberal economy, re-enters arts infrastructure and threatens to destabilize this infrastructure as well, which you can see when you look at how museums, the institutions of art, museums and art galleries have fared in recent history. One of the most visible places where the neoliberal, this idea of the creative economy took hold was in the building boom for museums that really began in 1997 with the construction of the Guggenheim in Bilbao. And the catchphrase associated with this was the Bilbao effect, which designated how a star museum like the Frank Gehry designed Guggenheim could revitalize a down on its luck former industrial economy, community.
So across the United States and really across the world, this production of flashy new museums by trendy architects with all kinds of promises about their collateral benefit to the economy. Now the thing about this is a museum is a very strange thing to try and build to revitalize your economy. I mean, think about it, there are all kinds of other things you could build. Museums on their own are terrible businesses. Almost no museum, not even a star museum like the Museum of Modern Art, sustains itself through its ticketing. You know, they depend for their existence on state funding and or donations from very wealthy people. So in hindsight, although not in hindsight because I wrote about this at the time, what is obvious is that the Bilbao effect was really a kind of civic sounding way for important people to justify something they were going to do anyways, which is this kind of building. There's a little funny book, a little book that just came out called In the House of the Balloon Dog, which is a sociological look at the Museum of Contemporary Art of Chicago, and they have a really good passage that I think outlines what's actually happened. And it's a long passage, I'm going to read it now. Instead of decline, the neoliberal order forces institutions into a relentless spiral of growth. With reductions in public funding, museums need to seek corporate support. To gain and that such support, they need to attract larger audiences. To bring in larger audiences, exhibits have to become more spectacular. With more spectacular shows, exhibition costs are spiking. To cover these expenses, institutions need to be aggressive in seeking individual donations. To appeal to donors, museums have to become destinations that properly reflect on their benefactors and the art they lend or donate to the institution. To do this in style, old buildings have to be expanded, new ones erected. The bigger buildings have greater staffing needs and raise overhead costs. To cover these costs, museums have to pursue corporate support even more aggressively. To do so effectively, visitor numbers need to be increased even more, which requires more historic shows and even greater appeal to individual donors, et cetera, et cetera. It's a pretty good, I think, and pretty damning description of the real motives behind the Bilbao effect. Hasn't been driven by sort of serious thoughts about community revitalization. It's been driven by the irrational competition for fundraising dollars in a competition where wealth has become more consolidated and you become more dependent on the ego of individual donors. There's an article I quote in my book about this building boom that quotes one of these. They describe museum bosses as being in a kind of quiet pain about all the building that they had to do. And this director, I think it's the Nelson Atkins Museum, says, most museum directors know better. They get pushed into it by the trustees, that is, by the very wealthy people whose egos they increasingly depend upon. And the result has been an incredibly short-sighted boom in construction that's made the whole art infrastructure less sustainable in the long term. In extreme cases, museums like the Art Institute of Chicago have completed expensive new buildings and immediately had to lay off their own staff because the cost of running it had escalated beyond their means. In any case, in their desperation to attract funds, museums have made themselves much more expensive to run, and this is obviously not a sustainable course for them to be on. So that's the museum world. What about the heart of darkness, the art gallery world, the commercial art sphere? If you're an art, if you're an art person, you'll know that we live in a really unprecedented age of gallery expansion, and with some galleries becoming something previously unheard of, global chains, franchise chains like Pace Gallery or Gozian Gallery. I think last year, Gozian Gallery, which is the most famous example, they opened simultaneous Damien Hirst shows in something like 16 locations around the world, and gave out a prize for people who went to all of them. International gallery chains are, as Noah Horowitz puts it, among the purest extensions of economic globalization in the art market, enabling galleries to leverage their brand identity, access a widening client base, and provide economies of scale. However, it's important to note that these are just like museum world, where things, the exceptional case masks the reality, these are exceptional cases. The gallery world itself is very intensely unequal. There are an estimated 375,000 art and antiques dealers in the world. Of these, a mere 5,000 are said to be responsible for fully half of all the sales. So that's about 1%. Because of increasing wealth inequality, the fortunes of the top and mid-tier galleries are increasingly diverging. It is a quote from a report on the state of contemporary art dealer. It says, "The super wealthy remained as the primary buyers in the market after a recessionary period from 2007 to 2009. The upper and middle class have not been able to keep pace with the wealthiest buyers, and therefore the middle of the art market have been the worst affected by the recent financial crisis." And finally, the last note about the gallery sphere is that the most important trend in the art market in the last decade is a transition towards what people call the event-based art market, particularly in the last 10 years, which means basically the transition towards art fairs. Art fairs have become an increasingly visible and central part of the discourse around art. Galleries, which are usually pretty small businesses, are competing for business with auction houses, which are giant corporations that specialize in these sort of glamorous events where people compete against each other in public for art. So to try and compete with that, galleries have looked to these art fairs where hundreds of people come together over a weekend, 100 galleries come together over a weekend for fairs like Art Basel Miami Beach or Frieze. For a successful gallery, the average is now that about a third of their sales are done outside of their gallery in these international, outside of their home country in these international kinds of events. And that total is rising constantly as rich people become more and more accustomed to being entertained in this way in order to buy art. So the catch of this, which has been successful in sustaining, obviously there's been a lot of expansion in galleries, but this, you can do a lot of business at an art fair. You can stampede people toward, rich people towards buying things. But art fairs are also really expensive to do. They involve upfront fees that are in tens of thousands of dollars and shipping art internationally. To survive as a semi-successful art gallery now requires both maintaining a physical space and maintaining a presence at a constant series of temporary events. Which is expensive and probably unsustainable. This is also from the same trade report that I just quoted. Quote, "Many dealers commented that the expenses to run a gallery, especially when traveling and attending fairs, are not justified relative to the sales made via this channel. Some dealers reported that their gallery sales had fallen to as low as 5% of total sales." So ultimately, the art gallery system is on a unsustainable path as well for the majority of the actors in. So where at last does that leave the artists? That brings us to the artists. We know that the number of people who identify as visual artists or trying to become visual artists has grown considerably in recent years across the world. And unsurprisingly, the same kind of stratification that we see elsewhere has also been intensifying among artists, both in terms of their earnings and in terms of their career prospects. One popular guesstimate, this is from 2007, had it there were 80,000 artists who lived between the art capitals of New York and London. Of these, just 75 are superstar artists with seven-figure incomes. About 300 more are mature, successful artists who show with major galleries and earn six-figure incomes from art. Below that, even artists who were showing were not really sustaining themselves through their artwork, instead piecing together a living through various sorts of. So 375 is not a lot of people to be sustained by a $65 billion global art economy. The odds are not good that you're going to make it as an artist. So various studies of the art boom suggest that growing artistic employment, it means more people have become artists, or has been paradoxically accompanied by growing artistic unemployment and underemployment. That is, even as the art economy has expanded, it has definitely not expanded past enough to absorb the number of artists drawn in by sort of get-rich fables and all the hype. Becoming much more difficult to make it as an artist for the average person, not easier during the art, during an art boom. And meanwhile, art school has become a huge industry, which year after year churns out vast surpluses of people trained for careers that will simply be impossible. And not just a career as an artist, but also a career as a teacher, an art teacher, which has been traditionally what people do to sustain themselves. This is a quote from a recent book called Artists with PhDs, which argues that like there will have to be a visual arts studio art PhD because the book says, now at the start of the 21st century, MFAs, that's the Master of Fine Arts, are ubiquitous and effectively devalued. A recent job search for a plump position at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill attracted almost 700 candidates, the vast majority of whom would have had MFAs. The degree by itself has come to be little more than a requirement for the competition on the job market, somewhat akin to the requirement of a high school or college diploma. To compete, job candidates need to have an MFA and something else, such as an exhibition record or a second field of expertise. And that's the reality of the art economy as we know it today, which is pretty grim, pretty stressed out. So I'm at 24 minutes. Should I cut it or? I have 5 more minutes of material. Okay. So I did want to end with some light speculation on what this might all mean. If you follow the art press, there's just a lot of angst about this situation, which is to be expected. And I've increasingly sort of delighted, or I think it's funny, that it's sort of become almost a critical commonplace to compare today's situation to the collapse of the salon system in Paris in the 1800s. I think it's funny that people reach back that far, and shows how nerdy people are. And also, shows how dire the situation is. At the moment, it feels like the Paris salon of the 19th century, Will Gompertz said in The Guardian last year, where bureaucrats and conservatives combined to stifle the field of work. I don't know, I think it's interesting. It's interesting to replay that history. Under the French monarchy, representation at the official salon was open to artists only who had credentials in the state. And after the French Revolution, these exhibitions were made open to all in the name of democracy. The number of artists participating ballooned from about 800 entries of the first open salon in 1791 to well over 5,000 in 1870. Drawn by the promise of popular participation in the art system, the influx of artists led to an expansion of potential talent that outpaced the capacity of the old structures to absorb it. This expansion in turn gave birth to Bohemian society and the modern art movement, symbolically inaugurated by the Salon des Refusés of 1863. A number of important artists rejected the salon and demanded to be heard on their own, including people like Manet and Whistler. And as a recent book summed it up, and I think this is really the key quote, why this sort of example resonates with people right now. Having prompted many people to turn to art as a career and attracting large numbers of them to Paris, and having vastly expanded the audience for artworks, the French salon system contributed to its own demise by creating demands it could not satisfy. So you can see why this story, fable, narrative, or whatever you want to call it, would chime with people's experience of the present. I do think it's important to note, however, that what's missing, there's an obvious missing factor. It's not going to play out quite that way today. And that's what made the earlier change possible, was that it coincided with the rise of a new social form, which was the consolidation of capitalists, the modern middle class, and capitalism in France. Modern art was able to flourish. It became kind of a conduit for the values associated with these new social actors. In our present moment, there's a great deal of discontent, and likely a looming institutional and human crisis. But there's no new social form on the horizon in order to provide a counterpole to the current kind of artistic disorder. And that, finally, I just end by saying that that's why the project of building social movements and anti-capitalist movements, movements that envision a better world, intersects with the project of art.